On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we continue our series, The Lines Between Us, with a conversation about race, class, and affirmative action. Earlier this summer, the Supreme Court sent an affirmative action case back to a lower court. But when it did, it signaled that the court is willing to consider backing away from race as a criteria in affirmative action in favor of socioeconomic status. The case was brought by a white plaintiff, Abigail Fisher, against the University of Texas when she was denied admission in 2008 because of an affirmative action program based on race. So what would so-called economic affirmative action look like? What would it mean for low-income and high-income people of color? We begin with the perspective of Sean Reardon. He's a professor of education at Stanford University who studies issues of race and class in education, particularly the achievement gap between students of color and white students. Senior producer Lawrence Lanahan asked him how the dynamics of the achievement gap have changed over the last few decades in terms of class and race.
And the racial achievement gap, particularly the black-white gap, was huge in the 1960s and narrowed a lot through the 70s and 80s and has been very slowly declining a little bit more over the last two decades, but it's still quite huge. It's equivalent to maybe the difference between a fifth grader and an eighth grader in terms of academic skill. The other trend to keep an eye on is the income achievement gap, the gap in test scores between high and low income kids, and that was relatively small in the 60s and 70s and started to grow dramatically in the 80s and 90s, and now is much larger than the black-white gap. So the average high-income child scores maybe four or more grades higher than the average low-income child on test scores.
So if there's a difference between like a fifth grade level and an eighth grade level of race, you're talking a difference between fifth and ninth, fifth and tenth?
That's right.
What does the achievement gap by class look like by the time you get to high school? These kids, when they're dropping out or when they're graduating, how big is the gap?
Quite large. I mean, probably 4 to 5 grades worth of difference if we measured in grades. When you look at test scores, things like SAT test scores, in a recent study, we found that about 15% of high-income children went to the most selective colleges and only about 2% of low-income children.
What are the implications here for higher education? We're about to have a conversation about the role class could play in affirmative action.
Colleges do take lots of things into account now, but many of them don't take class into account in a particularly overt way, and we might want them to do that more. On the other hand, I would caution us against sort of replacing race-based affirmative action with class-based affirmative action. They would achieve different goals. If our goal is to sort of remedy some of the past wrongs and disadvantages of minority students, then race-based affirmative action is the best way to do that. Class-based affirmative action isn't a great substitute for race-based affirmative action. But if our goal is to help disadvantaged children, whatever their race, get into more selective colleges, then class-based affirmative action is the better policy. That is, the conversation really has to be about what our goals are and then about the mechanisms separate rather than the mechanisms first.
Sean Reardon is a professor of education at Stanford University. He spoke with senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. On 88.1, you're listening to The Lines Between Us. We turn now to two writers who have personal experience with affirmative action, who have written about the complexities of race and class. John Blake grew up in an impoverished neighborhood in West Baltimore. He graduated from Howard University in 1987. He's now a writer and producer for CNN.com. He joins us on the phone from Atlanta. Good morning and welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
April Yvonne Garrett is the curator and host of the AYG List, a lifestyle inspiration and social commentary blog, which will soon be a radio show on the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. April, welcome back. Good to see you.
Happy to be here.
So, John, you wrote this really provocative essay for CNN.com called I Was an Affirmative Action Imposter. Explain what you meant by that.
Well, what I tried to do with the piece was give a different perspective on the usual debates about affirmative action. Usually we tell stories about blacks who go into white settings and they don't feel like they belong, and other people don't feel like they belong. Well, in my situation, I went to an all-black college, Howard University, But because of the class difference, I still felt like an imposter. I still felt like I didn't belong. And I almost flunked out of college, and it took me a long time trying to make that transition.
And your experience, as you look back on it now, do you think that your experience would have been considerably different had you been in a predominantly white institution, given that the difference, you write, you know, that your hang-up wasn't race, it was class. Would that have been the same had you been at a not an HBCU place?
Yeah, I still would have had a difficult transition, but I think it would have been even more difficult. In fact, I almost got a chance to go to College Park, University of Maryland, and I was so disappointed that I didn't go. But in retrospect, if I went there, I don't think I would have made it, because at least at Howard, in a black school, they kind of anticipated some of the things that I felt. There was more support. My friends were a little bit more supportive when they discovered, you know, the type of neighborhood I came from.
And April Yvonne Garrett, we want to think, we desperately want to think, that we live in a post-racial society. But the facts don't back that up. Race is still a very important criteria and parameter of every person's life, white and black. You went to Kenyon College and then did graduate work at Columbia and Harvard, predominantly white institutions. How has that informed your take on what's going on now, particularly in higher education?
I'm from a working class family. I'm the first in my family to attend college. And I chose a extremely predominantly white institution in the middle of cornfields in Ohio, Kenyon College, where I was the only black student in all of my classes until one class my senior year. I also went to graduate school at predominantly white Ivy League institutions. And one of the things that I never lose track of with regard to affirmative action and conversations about affirmative action is the history that came before it, right? It is a remedy for discrimination that we had to legalize because there were laws on the books that were codified that said people from certain backgrounds cannot have access to things that they need to actually build a healthy life in this country. So I think part of my concern about conversations about race-based affirmative action being open to class-based affirmative action is that I think they're complementary. I think that affirmative action for people of color, for women, has to do with the fact that you are in the class that you're in if you're in those groups, largely because you've been discriminated against because of your race. And I think that there's a way in which affirmative action policies can also inform policies around class that will help us to amplify folks who want to end those class disparities as well.
April Yvonne Garrett is the curator and blogger on the AYG list, and she'll soon be a radio show talk show host on the Tavis Smiley Network. John Blake joins us from Atlanta. He's a writer and producer for CNN.com. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to The Lines Between Us on 88.1 WYPR. So, John Blake, in your situation, when you went to Howard, was it an affirmative action situation? Were they particularly looking for people of lower income strata than many of their other students? Did they seek you out or did you seek them out?
Well, kind of both. That's historically part of the tradition in historically black colleges. They will give black students a break or a chance to go to college where other institutions wouldn't really reach out to them. And I had a really low SAT score of 830, so I was like I told someone today, I was considered a dummy, and you know, I didn't really have that much of a future. But Howard took a chance on me, and even though it was a real big adjustment, I eventually graduated with honors, so I made that adjustment. But I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Howard.
How do you think, in practical terms, an economic affirmative action program would work? What would the criteria be?
Ooh, that's a deep policy question. I mean, it would have to be a certain income level.
And would it be? Do you think it would be completely blind to race?
On the surface, from my reporting, it would be blind. But the practical reality is that you would end up getting a higher number of poor blacks and poor Latino people because they overrepresented among poor people. So some people say it's kind of like an indirect way to get affirmative action. If you can't get political support for race-based college admissions, don't try that approach. Try economic affirmative action. You'll get the same thing.
Yeah, April, what do you think about that?
I think my perspective on it is a lot more generative because I've been in the room where that policy is being set. That's not to say that I didn't have to bring a bat sometimes and say, look, these are the things that you're missing. And so when you have students of color who have had great experiences, they're your best selling points. And that happens in higher education, but that also happens in employment. So this whole notion about, you know, we have these unqualified people who are coming in and they're skating by and they're just kind of coming through. I really don't think if you look at most of the institutions who kind of embrace this, right, who really take it on as something that they value as a community, that they're interested in having anybody in the environment that will not be allowed to flourish.
And John, when April wrote on her blog, she made the point, it's an obvious one, that, you know, affirmative action is not a free ticket. I mean, it gets you in the door, but then you've got to prove yourself and you've got to deliver, as you yourself did at Howard. You said, you talk about how you had a rough start, but then you finished by graduating with honors. There are those who say that eliminating race as a criteria for affirmative action would work to the detriment of people of color. How would you respond to that?
Let me make sure I understand. They're saying that if you eliminate race-based, like college admissions, based on affirmative action, that's going to hurt blacks?
Yes. I mean, if you move to an economic affirmative action model rather than a race-based model, that could be to the detriment of people of color.
Well, I could see that potentially happening. But, you know, I just wonder at this point if... You know, we're talking about can we still use race-based affirmative action? I just wonder if it's even feasible to even argue that we can do that now. It just seems like there's no political support for it, not enough political support for it.
But John, might I suggest this? You know, when affirmative action and all of the civil rights imperatives were meted out, I mean, there was no moral support for it either. So, you know, part of what troubles me about the exchanges that we have in the media with regard to this particular area is, one, we kind of ahistoricize everything and it's right. Completely taken out of context, right? So we really have to put it in the context. And for me, part of what, you know, troubles the waters for me about these conversations is it's an either and or proposition. We don't really kind of talk about the fact that, yes, race still matters when we have, you know, a rodeo where, you know, we're right. Mocking the president and, you know, my beloved Adam Jones is getting, you know, who's a Baltimore Oriole, is getting, you know, bananas thrown at him. Or, you know, you have a white slash Hispanic man who can track down a black child and shoot him and kill him. And there's no, quote unquote, justice for that. Race matters. Race has not stopped mattering. We do not live in a post-racial society where we can really honestly say that race doesn't matter. What I think we have to stop doing is playing into the political game of it has to be class, it has to be race, and not even, mind you, talking about gender or disability, right? We're not even talking about the fullness of it.
I agree with you that you can't argue that racism isn't still a huge factor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in an ideal situation, you could have both, you know, race
yeah.
and class. But affirmative action was meant to be temporary. And secondly, you have this huge problem with income inequality now, where you have poor whites and poor Latino students who don't have opportunities. So how do you still argue for a race-based affirmative action when you know, one, it was meant to be temporary, and two, you have all these other poor students who aren't black who can't get to college?
Well, one, yeah, it's meant to be temporary, but I've not seen the evidence. If you have it, please show it to me, where we are at a moment where it is no longer needed. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I don't think the class disparity is new. I think we need to pay attention to it. I think we need to construct, you know, legal redress to it, as we did with affirmative action. And we need to be serious about that. And I think we need to build some coalitions around that.
And John, I want to go back to this notion of goals. 10 years ago, before, you know, in 2003, another Michigan case about affirmative action, the court affirmed two things. Number one, that affirmative action can redress past wrongs. But number two, equally important, they said, was to create a diverse environment for all students so that everybody benefits from being in a diverse environment. Are those two, and of course, how you get to those goals, whether that's a race-based thing or an economic-based thing, is the question on the table. But are those two goals, in your mind, equal? And are they still as important as they were when the court weighed in on them 10 years ago?
I do think they're still very important. Even though five people in the court may not think so, if you look throughout popular culture, particularly among younger people, you just see so much emphasis on people of different races hanging out, forming friendships, being close. So it seems like no matter what the court has decided, a new generation come up, they've decided that it is important. But that's just in a social setting. I mean, it's one thing for us to be integrated like socially, but when it comes to, you know, questions of power, political power and economic questions, you know, that's the true test, I think, about integration and the goals of diversity. Even if you go, say, with an economic-based approach, the people I talked to said that a lot of colleges won't embrace that. They don't make money off of poor students. They won't really go after poor students. So I don't know if even that will work.
And April, you're shaking your head.
Well, it's just not my lived experience. You know, I attended Kenyon College in Columbia. I worked at Emory University in Atlanta. It's just not, I don't know where this is coming from because it's not my lived experience. But what I will say about that, too, is that at every institution that I've attended, there are strong alums who have influence. There are communities around those colleges and universities that have influence. The same thing with employment, because I don't want to get us stuck on education, because I think every time we have this conversation about affirmative action, it's about, you know, access to education. And education is important, but it's also about access to employment. So part of it is we need to exercise a moral imperative where it's not okay for us to say, okay, well, we just don't have the support for this, so therefore we're going to go another way. If it is an important thing to address, i.e. race or gender or class, then we have to muster the courage to build coalitions around making those things important and putting them before policymakers and legislators in an important and substantive way so that we pull this thing out by the root once and for all, period, end of sentence.
I think what April talks about sometimes that when something's morally right, you don't look at the polls, you don't see who's on the Supreme Court, you fight for that. I mean, if we didn't have that attitude, we wouldn't have the civil rights movement, we wouldn't have all these things. So I think that's a great point. I do have another question, though. She talked about the coalition we can build with other people. I think that's really important that poor working class blacks build coalitions with, like, with poor Latino, Asian. I think it seems like we would have a better chance of building that kind of coalition if we talk a little bit more about class than race. I just wonder about that.
I think it's a good thing to wonder about, but I think my personal kind of sentiment around this is I don't have any hang-ups about being a black person who benefited from affirmative action because my ancestors died for that, period, end of sentence, right? Because when my people came here, we were chattel, right? And we fought for this redress. So I think part of it for me is we have to get over the guilt of this being, you know, the quote-unquote set-aside. It's not a set-aside. It is addressing, you know, systemic discrimination that was afforded to us by a country who backed it up. So part of it is I think we have to relanguage it, right? I think we have to create another set of values and languaging around what this is about and to have a little bit more of a pride about it as opposed to being so scarred by it and traumatized by it. That's just my perspective. And I hope to talk to you some more. It's always good to talk to a brother from Baltimore.
Okay, well, thank you.
Well, John Blake, I hope to talk to you some more as well. And I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much. And April Yvonne Garrett as well. We appreciate your being here. And we will continue this conversation online. And thanks so much. We'll have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Blake is a writer, producer for CNN.com. We've got a link to his essay, I Was an Affirmative Action Imposter, on our website for this series, linesbetweenus.org. April Yvonne Garrett can be heard starting September 10th on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 3:30 on Blog Talk Radio on the Tavis Smiley Network as the host of the AYG List. We'll have a link to that as well on our website. Again, come to linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. After a break, a perspective on the lines between us from students who have given this a lot of thought. Stay with us.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
Welcome back to The Lines Between Us on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. As we consider the lines that divide us between race and class, we wanted to get the perspective of some young people who have given the issue of race a lot of thought. Every year, Princeton University awards the Princeton Prize in Race Relations to high school students from across the country who are working to improve race relations in their schools and in their communities. Two of this year's honorees are from Baltimore. Here with me in the studio is Evadie Ngoy. She's 16 years old, and she's the winner of the 2013 Princeton Prize. And next week, she'll begin her junior year at Digital Harbor High School in Federal Hill. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you.
And Iman Williams is 18 years old. She's one of the certificate recipients of this year's Princeton Prize. She graduated last spring from the Park School. It's a private school in Baltimore County. She joins us on the phone from Atlanta, Georgia, where she is about to begin attending Emory University. Iman, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Evadie, let's start with you. You came to the United States from the Congo. Tell us when that happened and under what circumstances.
I came to the United States in 2006 with my mom and brother. We came in search of a good life, you know, how everyone comes to this country in search of to live better and to be better. And we came to this country to rejoin our father who was already here. And we've been here since 2006.
And what's your experience as an immigrant to the United States and as a high school student here in the U.S.?
I think my experience overall has been wonderful, but there's been some up and downs. I've experienced, you know, hard times where I wasn't proud of who I was or wasn't proud of where I was coming from because of the fact that I was going to a public school where, you know, many students didn't know much about Africa, so they were kind of ignorant about the fact that I was different, about the fact that I was coming from a different place, so they kind of tend to, make fun of where I was coming from and make fun of who I was.
And these were students who were, was there any particular identification with any other races that took particular, you know, interest in your African heritage?
Well, mostly African Americans, and that's what confused me the most, because I was looking at the African American students and myself, and I saw no difference in skin color and everything. But it still surprises me that there's a barrier between African Americans and Africans.
And Iman, you moved to Baltimore from Atlanta. Now you're back in Atlanta for college, but back in 2009, you moved up here. So you had a transition to make as well while you were in high school. What were your impressions when you started school here in Baltimore, and how does the Park School differ from the school you attended before in Atlanta?
I experienced several different types of education, so the discrepancies between the schools I attended was overt. So I became almost hypercritical about myself, about my privilege, and how that impacted my life and how that played a role in the lives of other people as well.
And Evadie, you, one of the reasons you won the Princeton Prize was that you made a film.
Yes.
With the folks at Wide Angle Media, mm-hmm. program that you've been involved in. It's called The Paradise That Wasn't. You presented it at the TEDx conference here in Baltimore back in January, and you were on the program talking about it at that time. It focuses on the experiences of young refugees in Baltimore, including other Africans. Do you find that the experiences that the other people who are immigrating and coming as refugees are similar to yours? Is this are you all bonded by this?
Yeah. We all, like, interviewing them just made me realize that we all have had the same experience. And through the film, I was able to create this network of refugees to help one another with their experience. Like, we're able to tell them, you know, we experienced this too. You can be strong and you can go through it no matter what people tell you.
And Iman, when you graduated from the Park School, at that point, you'd been at Park for how many years? Lost track of the dates. Four. And when you had these conflicts that you felt about privilege and class and the things you alluded to, how did you address those? What did you do? What were some of the activities you were involved in?
The school that I attended had a small cohort of faculty members and students who come together once a week to talk about diversity, which is incredible, and it gave everyone an outlet. You know, it was very relieving to have an opportunity to have discussions like this and be transparent. But it's also important to consider who's showing up to the table and who isn't, which voices are being heard and which voices aren't. That conversation isn't being had everywhere. I try to step outside of the bubble and try to be a little bit more civically engaged. So I started working at a nonprofit in Baltimore City called The Intersection.
Iman, what is your family's heritage? Where are they from?
My father is African American, and my mother is Ethiopian, and she came to America when she was about my age.
And so the divides that you might experience, are they along racial lines? Are they along religious lines? You're a practicing Muslim, am I right about that?
Correct.
How does that impact the experiences that you've had?
Well, I feel like I've been navigating several different worlds all of my life. And so I think that although it was relatively difficult, it gave me a lot of insight. And I think it helped me confront my privilege kind of early on. So I started thinking about, you know, classism and elitism and white normativity and heteronormativity, you know, gender identity, visibility, racism, sexism, and intersectionality being multiple things that aren't necessarily opposed to one another. You know, being a Black, African-American, an African, Muslim who is a female, being heterosexual, and a lot of people, you know, people are multifaceted.
Iman Williams is one of this year's certificate recipients of the Princeton Prize. She joins us on the phone from Atlanta. Evadine Ngoy is here in the studio. She is the winner of the 2013 Princeton Prize and a student at the Digital Harbor High School. You're listening to The Lines Between Us on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. So, Evadine, what about that conversation? Is this a conversation, obviously your film, I would hope, sparked a conversation. Is this a conversation that the students at Digital Harbor have?
The issue of race, culture, religion is one issue. It's an hard issue, and not everybody can understand it well as I have come to understand it, or Iman have come to understand it. And it's not easy for the students at Digital Harbor just to start talking about it. I remember there was a week at Digital Harbor where the film, The Paradise That Wasn't, was being screened throughout the classes. And the class I was in, it was screened as well. And after the film was screened, the teacher asked, does anyone have anything to say about race or anything else? The students were quiet because it's just an issue that sparks a lot of things and it scares people, in fact. Race is an important thing, and I always tell people, wherever you go, race might be an important thing, but the thing to realize is that you and I are human beings. You have a heart, and I have a heart. There shouldn't be any difference or any barrier between us or anything that can stop us from being together and working together.
And I don't think anybody would disagree with that, right? But the divides are clearly there in
they
our
are.
Society.
They
you
are.
Know, they're there with young people. They're mm-hmm. there with older people. So what do you think is the fundamental source of that divide?
Not knowing.
So it's an issue of understanding.
Of understanding. I think that every race, they come together to discuss the issues that concern them. But I'm wondering if every race could come together and ask themselves questions that they don't understand about the other race, that something that they question about the other race, to come together, you know, to give knowledge to the other person, that separation comes of not knowing the other race or the fear of knowing, actually.
Obviously, race is a thing that when people think about diversity, they think automatically about race. But Iman, are there other issues that sometimes, and places of divide that sometimes get overlooked?
Definitely. I think ableism is a huge, huge thing that gets overlooked. And, you know, ageism, sexism, gender identity, which is a little bit more complex than sex, and, you know, heteronormativity, elitism, and classism, and white normativity. Those are all things I think aren't talked about as much as race. That's not to say that they are less important or more important, but those are things that I do think are important to bring up.
Ebony, what about the divide, if there is one? Do you sense that there is a divide between kids who go to private school and kids who go to public school?
Unfortunately, I do sense a divide in the sense that, you know, a student who's going to a public school and a student who's going to a private school, there's that divide that you feel as if the student who goes to the private school is getting a better and a higher education than you who are going to a public school.
Iman, what's your take on that as well?
Well, I don't want to suggest that, you know, all private schools are homogenous or that all public schools and charter schools are homogenous. However, I do think that there's a fundamental difference between private schools and schools that aren't private, in that there's kind of an underlying separatist notion. Because, you know, private school is private, it's exclusive. So there are people that are being turned away from private school. And that is something that has always been conflicting for me. Everyone has a right to an education, and everyone should have the right to choose what type of education they want to receive.
What are you going to major in at Emory? Have you figured that out yet?
I'm passionate about neuroscience and public policy. So we'll see which one I end up deciding, or if I can kind of merge the two.
And Ebony, you've got a couple of years left of high school, but after that, what are your thoughts about the future at this point?
I want to major in filmmaking because I feel as if filmmaking is the way that I can address the issues that really concern me. And not only will I continue to talk about, you know, the issue of race and culture and religion, but to also take action in it. So this upcoming junior year, I want to create a diversity group at Digital Harbor where students can come together and talk and address about the issue of race, diversity, and all those other things.
And Iman, do you intend to be involved in that kind of activity at Emory the way you were at the Park School with getting groups together and sparking discussions?
Absolutely.
Well, have a great college career. I hope you enjoy it. And thank you so much for your time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And Ebony, thank you as well. And,
oh, thank you.
Break a leg this year, junior year.
Thank you.
Ebony Nagoya is entering her junior year at the Digital Harbor High School here in Baltimore. Iman Williams is a freshman at Emory University in Atlanta. They're both honorees in this year's Princeton Prize in Race Relations given by Princeton University. There were two other students from Baltimore who were also honored with the Princeton Prize. They are Michelle Nee and Mashad Mahor. We've got a link to Ebony's film and Iman's editorial in the Baltimore Sun, which is one of the activities she was involved in to qualify for the Princeton Prize. We've also got a lot more information about the Princeton Prize. Come to our website, linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass, and you've been listening to The Lines Between Us. Again, go to linesbetweenus.org for more stories and to tell your story. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus. Or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.